Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books in Animal Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Marcela Hernandez, a PhD candidate in philosophy at the University of Frankfurt, and I will be the host of the channel today with an interview to one of the leading voices in animal history, Dr. Nigel Rotfels, who recently published the book Elephant Trails, A History of Animals and Cultures. Dr. Rotfels, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Marcela. It's nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, it's great to have you. First, I wanted to tell you, to ask you if you could tell us about yourself a little bit. How has your own history led you to become interested in animals and zoos, and specifically then elephants?
Thank you. Well, I think sometimes, people ask you how long you took to write a book or something. And the answer is always, my whole life, because you're always working towards it. And I don't know, when I was a child, it was my thing to go to the zoo. I don't know why that is. It was something that I got to do in a family of other children, and I was the youngest. So if the family was traveling, maybe it was a way for me to own everyone's behavior for a little while and make them do what I wanted to do. But for whatever reason, that became sort of part of my early sort of ideas about what I enjoyed. And also kind of obsessed about nature programming on television when I was growing up. So I don't know. When I went to college, I decided to study biology, and then unfortunately took a history class, and my course changed. And then I went to grad school, not really knowing what I was going to do. I went to Harvard University, and I think I talked a little bit about wanting to study European history or something like that when I applied. When it came time to picking a dissertation topic, the recommendation of one of my faculty was that I choose something I just really enjoy. And so I started thinking more about the history of biology, and the history, especially of natural history. And then I thought of zoos. And when I proposed this idea, I think, honestly, people were a little perplexed about whether that's a good idea or not. When it came down to being excited about the work that I was going to do, it sort of began to make a lot of sense that I would study zoos and history and Europe and possibly especially Germany. In mostly the 19th century. And I think I've been mostly in the 19th century since, at least, more maybe up to World War I. And so that's where my graduate work began. And then after getting my PhD, I wrote a dissertation that was essentially about Carl Hagenbeck and his business. And I really encourage people not to read my dissertation. I am one of many, I think, who was very happy to see that in the past. But when it came time to revise my dissertation, I went about it a fairly significant revision and then really began to enjoy the work. I think that's when I really began to enjoy writing.
So it's a normal thing not to enjoy the process of writing a dissertation, right?
Dissertations, the kind of expectations around dissertations, maybe this is just my experience. I sort of sometimes found writing a dissertation of being about lowering the bar every day about what one about what one thought one was going to write, but writing books is something different. That's about having the opportunity to write what one really loves.
That's great to hear.
Ideally.
And how did you come specifically to write Elephant Trails? Can you point to something like an origin for this particular book?
Sure. I think one of the earliest images that I found when I was working on my zoo work was a image of a little elephant that was captured in the field. The photograph was taken of him with his mother after his mother had been shot by the hunter. And so it was before he had been captured. And I was just really taken aback by the image and the kind of horror of it, honestly. I ended up using that image in my first book, in Savages and Beasts. I didn't use it in this book, but it is that image and the story of that particular elephant really is the background of this whole project. So that takes me back then. So you need to notice I did my dissertation research in the late 80s, the late 1980s. So we're talking, more than 30 years ago, sorry, when I found that image, 35 years ago, I probably found that image. And it's sort of stayed with me. And I have to say, my feelings about the person who photographed that elephant have changed a lot over time. The way I wrote about him when I wrote my first book is not how I would write about him today. But that image stayed with me. And I thought I had sort of imagined it would be wonderful just to do kind of a biography of that elephant. And then when I settled on that concept, I realized that it was going to be a book that in which that individual elephant's life is only a very, very tiny spot. I think it happened. I think I talk about it maybe just in a few pages in the introduction, but otherwise, it's throughout. Yeah.
Good. Well, you begin your book with a story that appears in the Udana, one of the canonical texts where the teachings of the Gautama Buddha were written. The Buddha is told that some wanderers of various sects came to the village and began discussing religious truths. This prompted him to tell the parable of the blind man and the elephant. Can you tell us this story and why you chose it, as I take it, as the basic premise of your book?
Oh, thank you. I love these questions. Thanks, Marcella. It's a profound story. I think it's one of those stories that's been that's with us in ways, even if we don't know the story. It's a story about our ability to know things, especially very, very profound and complex things. Right. So people probably know the story is that, that this group of blind men put their hands on an elephant and are asked what an elephant is. And each describes the elephant differently because each is seen, if you will, just a part of the elephant. And the Buddha says that that the followers of the various sects are like these men. They each see a part of the truth, but because that's only what that part is the only part they see, they think they see the whole thing. And so for me as an historian, I think what I wanted to write about and the reason that the image is on the cover of the book, and as you're right, it's a theme that goes through the whole book, is that historically we are seeing always only a small part of what an elephant is, and what we see has very much to do with our individual position, so not just where we are with our hands on the elephant, but where we are historically, where we are culturally, and over time. So part two of the lesson of the blind man and the elephant, I believe, is that there is a way to imagine all those impressions of the elephant, of the truth, all those partial visions of truth as together constituting something closer to the whole truth, that we'll never know what an elephant is thinking, what an elephant really is. But I do believe that we are getting closer to a deeper understanding. And that's part of a kind of optimistic historical trajectory that I'm probably disinclined to mostly accept. But I also believe it's sort of true. I think we are, in fact, more aware of the lives and minds and thoughts of elephants, even though they're something that we'll never truly understand. We're closer than we have been in the past.
Yeah, and we're probably still beginning to imagine certain things about animals in general and elephants specifically that we couldn't imagine before. So the image of the elephant is changing and can change, and it's not just what we see now, but what we could see in the future. I think that's interesting.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think I hope also that a lesson of the book is about humility and about our ability to understand history and understand ourselves, that it's always partial and incomplete, and our ability to understand elephants is always partial and incomplete, and that the worst things that have happened to elephants over time, I think, have happened because people thought they knew all about them. And so I think partly what I wanted to get to by the end of the book is for people to not think that they know everything there is to know about an elephant.
Mm-hmm. Once you think you know about something or someone, then you think you can dominate this person or thing. That's like the premise of colonial thought and practices.
Well, I mean, that's partly why I guess I've always been attracted to the 19th century, maybe a little bit what Jarius Grove refers to as the Euro scene, this sort of this historically specific and particular confidence that Europeans felt they both knew what the world meant, and that gave them the confidence to decide what should happen with people and with lands and with animals all around the world. Yeah.
Yeah. one of the ideas that have been most persistent in time and that remains as present as ever is that elephants are noble, that is, they're highly sensible, friendly to humans, even mystical in some reports, and also wise, that is, extraordinarily intelligent and possessing a sharp memory. And this idea has a long history, dating back even to a Sinbad story in Arabian Nights, and especially since the translation of this work in the 18th century, first to French and then to every major European language. But this idea contrasts clearly with another notion that was particularly common in written memoirs of hunters, animal traders, circus managers from the mid-18th century through the early 20th, namely that elephants are vicious monsters, the most abominable and feared living creature on earth. Can you tell us a little bit about the unfolding of these two competing narratives?
Oh, thank you. Yes. So I think I hope that when people see that kind of contrast between, you know, the elephant as noble and peaceful and emotional, and the elephant as dangerous and deadly. They will also see how those kinds of characterizations are rooted in human cultures and human moments in time, and are being deployed for certain kinds of reasons that are, you know, sort of connected to the philosophies of the moment, right? I have written a little bit about something I call the enlightened elephant. This like how the elephant became kind of to some degree a kind of fascination for enlightenment thought in the 18th century. And that's where partly this image of the elephant as particularly wise, judicious, thoughtful, also passionate, which is also within enlightenment thought, really takes hold. And then this other image of the elephant as deadly and vicious growing out of the second half of the 19th century, the rogue elephant. The rogue elephant doesn't exist in Western thought in the 18th century, but it does exist in the second half of the 19th century, that potentially that there are elephants out there that are out to kill people. And that is very much kind of an invention of a colonial mentality, I hope that when people see things like that, they'll also question some of their own assumptions about what we mean when we talk about elephant emotion today, elephant wisdom today. At some point in the book, I think I compare elephants to oak trees. I've always been struck by how often oak trees, like elephants, are characterized as particularly wise and grave. And I think I say something like, I'm not sure. They may well be, but why we think so is the sort of question that interests.
Yeah. And this is related to another of the commonplaces that Western cultures have had about elephants, namely that they have a special rapport to death, that they have spiritual lives, which are accounted for in the rituals when a member of the kin dies, or that as soon as they forebode their own death, they go hide in special places, sometimes described as elephant graveyards, but also that they cry their dead. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah. Again, it's a very, very old story, something that has really attracted Western authors. And one should say that this book is sort of very generally situated in Western thought. And I think that's a completely, you know, it's a a reasonable critique of it. It does not, it really engage much with Indian authors or African authors around elephant ideas, because again, I'm basically a European historian, and it's where my work is. And while I love to be in conversation with those people, it's not people working in those areas. It's not really an area that I have the expertise in that I feel I can actually write in. So in any case, yeah, the idea of the elephant graveyard, became very important to me because I started going to natural history museums and photographing elephant bones in their collections. This was sort of a project I started. In a way, it is incomplete. I'm still thinking about it a little bit, but I ended up with a collaborator going to various collections and spending quite a bit of time just photographing the bones that are kept in collections. Some of these collections, for example, the Natural History Museum's storage facility in London, the elephant bone collection there just it's really goes on and on. And there's so many remains in the collection. So I began to wonder about those kinds of places as elephant graveyards, and a different kind of elephant graveyard, one that elephants end up in not by choice. But the longer history of elephant graveyards goes back to classical writers, and the idea that elephants understand the coming of their own deaths, understand what death is, and have a kind of understanding of religion and spirituality has been very persistent. And exactly where it comes from, again, might be related to some of those ideas about wisdom and it may just come from empirical observations as well. There has certainly been, I think a lot of people might be familiar with the films, especially of Echo and others surrounding elephant mourning rituals that are sometimes described as elephant mourning rituals. So that is a sort of a strange little thread in the scientific literature that that also really interested me. Ian Douglas Hamilton describes it. Joyce Poole describes it. Others have described elephants coming across the bones of deceased elephants and responding to them in ways that they feel are very different from how elephants respond to other kinds of bones and objects in the environment. I can say a couple of things from personal experience. I have definitely seen elephants suffering from grief, and I describe an elephant who was very important to me, who suffered deeply from the loss of a companion. The sort of scientific basis for things like elephant tears, which is something that has been described over centuries, and the way that elephants do or do not respond to elephant bones in particular ways, that is a very fraught literature, actually, from my perspective. It's pretty much far from conclusive about anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mourning is different than crying, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
I liked that. I think what Jeffrey Mason and Susan McCarthy in their book, When Elephants Weep, said something like, tears are not themselves grief. They are an outcome of grief, and their interest is more in the possibility of grief. And that strikes me as a really a wise way to think about it in a way, right? It's like just because you know somebody who is not crying does not mean that they're not suffering.
Mm-hmm. And you can also cry and not be suffering.
Yeah,
and I think this is one of the points where your thesis is made more explicit, that the Western mentalities try to see in something like an elephant, things that they feel is important and interesting. And so it would be, of course, extraordinary if we found an animal, a non-human animal that could actually shed tears. And I think this is one of the things, this is one of the reasons why it's been so persistent, this kind of myth of elephant tears.
I think you're right. I think while you were talking, I was thinking a little bit about the mirror recognition test, right? That elephants, it is argued, are one of the animals that are able to understand that they are looking at themselves in a mirror. Something I also discuss in the book. But the other part, I think, of a mirror with the elephant is that it's so often reflecting what we want to see. Because I've always visited zoos and I listen to people visiting zoos and I talk to keepers. One of the archives of this book is conversations with keepers I've known over many years. And it's always striking to me how people think they see something happening, and then you ask someone else and they're like, that's not what that is. That's something completely different. There's a story, and I won't name names, but there was a video I was sent once of some people playing guitar on the back of an elephant, on the backs of several elephants. They were on a sort of a forest adventure with elephants as a touristic thing, and they were playing guitars. And the video purported that the elephants were singing with the musicians, and the elephants were all squeaking like mad, and they sang more and more because they were having so much fun. And look, the elephants are singing with us. Well, the elephants were terrified. If you like present that video to people who work with elephants, they're like, oh my gosh, those elephants are freaking out. And they don't know what that sound is. And it's amazing. They're not just running away in fear. So that's this moment of, misunderstanding.
Yeah. And that's one of the points where critics, like the positions of critics and the positions of people that have worked closely with elephants, differ so greatly, right? Can you talk about, these two opposing positions and how you develop them in your book?
Well, people who've read work I've written before know that I can be quite critical of zoos, but not necessarily in the ways that other people might be. For me, I sometimes struggle making sort of very generalized statements that, you know, all zoos are bad or something like that. There are lots of reasons I do that, I suppose. One is, in the case of elephants, there are something like 300 elephants in captivity in the United States. And honestly, the quality of their life, of their lives, is very different from place to place. One of the real measures of the quality of lives that they have has to do with the kind of social world, in my opinion, has to do with the social world that they have around them. That can include other elephants, and sometimes it will only include people. And I think I want to say that sometimes the quality of those relationships can be quite important and quite profound. And when an animal lives for decades longer than most people will have as a career at a zoo, there can be a very significant relationships that they have with keepers. It's very difficult for me to characterize those people as evil or as sadistic or cruel or something like that when I know them and I know that they have devoted themselves in ways that I certainly couldn't taking care of another creature, their physical, emotional needs, just helping an elephant in captivity with its physical needs is such a task. It's such a huge task in the limited circumstances that so many elephants have in zoos, to keep them clean, to try to keep them as healthy as possible, and to keep them intellectually and emotionally stable in a very challenging circumstance. And, you know, the success is uneven, one has to say, the effort that I have seen over decades of people trying their best themselves in challenging circumstances makes me admire them, because I wrote a book a few years ago with a colleague, Dick Blau, who's a photographer and filmmaker, and it was called Elephant House, and it was the result of us visiting an elephant collection at the Oregon Zoo in Portland, Oregon, over the course of several years, and spending time with the keepers and spending time with the elephants. And I mean, I have to say the project started a little bit as a kind of a humorous comment to my friend Dick. I said something like, "Have you ever thought of shooting an elephant?" Which is a reference to the George Orwell story, but he's a photographer and he didn't know the story, so I gave him the story and the more we talked about it, the more excited he got about the idea of photographing an elephant. Actually, photographing an elephant poses all kinds of logistical problems. They don't fit very well in a camera. And so what tends to happen when people start photographing elephants is that they tend to sort of zoom in very close to skin or to eyes or other parts of bodies, and really sort of get excited about the formal characteristics or the formal elements of a body, so it took quite a while for his work to develop in that context as well as mine, watching him work, and then working with the keepers and getting to know them better. So it was a kind of a fascinating experience for me. But, you know, that's a place that has had a great deal of criticism over the years. And so, you know, one has to, when you engage in work like that, it was kind of fully knowing that this is a politically charged issue.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back to the subject of images a little bit later, but I would first like you to tell us, from all the stories that kind of configure this one history that you are proposing, stories of Gunda, of Alice, of Ned, of that later became Tusco, of Lily, is there one story that is closest to you that you would like to tell us about?
When I was doing the index, I think I counted 45 elephants named in the book, and many more not named. I think the book is dedicated, let me just open it, to a list of elephants. It says, in memory of Gunda, Alice, Josephine, Ned, Mina, Packy, Lily, and many more with and without names. That's a pretty good list of elephants who really impacted this project. Interesting omission in this list is the elephant who started the project. But of these, I think I would have to say, if I were to pick one, it might be Packy. And Packy maybe only appears on one or two pages of the book.
Yeah, because I don't even remember her.
Yeah, he's not, but Packy's a special one. Packy was born in April 1962, and I was born in 1962 in July. And when I was a child, I remembered reading in sort of children's nature magazines about this elephant that had been born in the United States. When Packy was born, he was the first elephant born in the United States in decades, I think over 40 years. It's not that elephants, you know, are particularly difficult to... I mean, it's not, I should say, it's not that people have been trying to have elephant babies during that period, because it was just honestly much simpler to import them from wherever you want. And there weren't that many male elephants in captivity because of challenges that male elephants in particular have in captivity. But anyway, I remembered Packy when I was reading about Packy from when I was a kid. When I eventually met Packy, we were in our 50s, and Packy had had one could see parts of Packy's history literally on his body, and he was a very big elephant. I hadn't been around many male elephants before. Packy was a male Asian elephant, he was probably the tallest elephant in North America when he was alive, times he was probably in the sort of 12,000 to 14,000 pound range. He was a very big elephant, but I've seen more massive elephants since meeting him, but I've never met one taller. I just have to say there was something about Packy which made me understand religion in different ways. I am not a spiritual person. I'm not a religious person. I grew up in a very secular home. And when I spent time with Packy, I began to understand, I think, a little bit more about elephants and temples, and why it makes sense to think about elephants in the same sort of thoughts as thoughts about truth and even some fairly big religious ideas. So those were some lessons that I learned from Packy. He had an extraordinary presence.
And when you talk about male elephants and their problems, or the problems that they cause in certain contexts, I couldn't help thinking about male humans as well. How do these two presences, play together, and how was the image of the male elephant used to, ennoble the spirit of certain males, human males?
So the kind of obvious target, if you will, in all of that is someone like Theodore Roosevelt, and this kind of quest to test himself that he had, to test himself against what he considered perhaps the most dangerous, but not the most dangerous for him, but the most challenging elephant animal to hunt. I think he felt that a wounded large cat could be much more dangerous than an elephant, than a wounded elephant. However, certainly his goal of hunting elephants was in part about testing his manhood against what he considered a kind of ultimate challenge. His was an obsession that was shared by others in the period of the great white hunters, a period, as far as I can tell, that continues to today. Being able to successfully pursue and kill, within his case, a very large gun, an elephant, was a way of, I think, of clarifying for himself his part of the meaning of his existence. And this is not an intellectual or emotional register that makes a great deal of sense to me. It's one that I recognize and I know it's not gone in the world, but it's one that does really, I think it's had a kind of profound effect on the planet. And so it's certainly one that I wanted to engage in. This book has a kind of melancholy tone all the way through. And I think I sort of felt a little bad about it at the end. You know, we're kind of used to there being something that lifts us up in nature documentaries. They've sort of dealt with that problem. It can't all be about, like, killing elephants or something. And I didn't want the book to be about that. I certainly didn't want the book to be about the spectacle of death. That's not where my work or ideas are right now. I think you're right, that there's a there's a world of gender that is in all of this as well. I'll just say one more thing about that. I mean, if you think about elephant keepers in zoos, one of the really extraordinary things over the last 50 years is that is how many more women are responsible for elephants in collections than it used to be. It used to be 100% what they called themselves, elephant men. And the practices of managing elephants in captivity and the people and their ideas and why they're doing it have been sort of remarkably changing over the last decades.
Yeah, that's also clear with some images of elephants, for example, with children and with women, right? Like this image with Helen Keller and how she described Alice, I think, the elephant as the kindliest of creatures. And how, you know, there's also like a different take on not only, you know, this gendered conception of elephants, but also how they have been used in imagery and publicity, etc.
Yeah. Well, that picture of Alice with Helen Keller is just fantastic. I'm happy to say that was one I proposed for the cover. I was like, I mean, this is such an amazing picture. Again, because she was blind, and she's touching this elephant, I actually truly believe that the photograph was partially arranged because of the story of the blind man and the elephant, but it becomes much more in her hands and in her discussion of her day at the zoo, the Bronx Zoo. And that photograph, obviously there's a long tradition of us by this I mean not me personally, but of people who've visited zoos and other kinds of collections over the last couple of centuries, of putting their children on the backs of elephants. One of the most sort of strangely improbable things, if you think about it. It's like, I mean, if it's bad enough to stick your kid on the back of a horse, sticking them on the back of an elephant, you just kind of have to wonder who thought this was a good idea. I have an acquaintance who I met once. We had been corresponding, and we arranged to meet at a cafe in London when I happened to be in England, and he brought with him these huge photo albums, and one was just of himself as a child on the backs of all these elephants, because he was just obsessed by them, and he was also obsessed with the whole kind of imagery around children riding elephants. And it was just extraordinary day of talking about his life. You know, one of the elephants in the book, Gunda, was brought really to be a ride elephant, and there's a photograph of Gunda in the book with children on his back and in front of Lake Agassiz at the Bronx Zoo. Just a fantastic picture, and one that, you know, you can pick up today. They were produced in so many copies at the time. And so I wanted to talk about that I think that how that kind of image is also related to certain kinds of children's stories we have about elephants. Obviously Babar, but also you know, even Horton and a few other elephants who have been part of are the way children have. So many children have been raised to think about elephants is something that I definitely wanted to talk about. I was glad that Babar made an appearance in the book. I didn't know, you know, in so many cases in writing this, you know, who or what was going to end up in it. I think one of the strange things about this book for me is that I've been writing and thinking about elephants for 20 years. And so when I wrote this, I literally just started on page one and wrote to the end. And I didn't know which stories would actually end up in it as I wrote it.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a fascination, kind of an inherent fascination that people have with elephants, partly because they're the character, like the imaginal character of elephants, the way that they have this monumental presence, and that, as you say, they're so difficult to frame in a camera. I think this is part of the kind of aura that they transmit of power and just size and weight and the fact that they have been used as writing devices, right? That children have been on and are being placed on their backs it's precisely because of this. The image power of that is like really, really striking.
I think I say somewhere in here that we may be hardwired in our brains to pause when we see an elephant. There's the fact that proboscideans are on the walls of prehistoric caves and in rock art in Asia and Africa and ubiquitous in the internet might be a clue that we can't not look at elephants and wonder.
Yeah, and be amazed.
That's right.
I thought one of the most complicated narratives of your book, that's also part of our most present ideas about elephants today, is the fact that some hunters were also conservationists, and they talked about the possibility of extinction. Can you just briefly talk about this?
Sure. I live in the Midwest. We don't have a lot of elephants that are wild here, but we are on a flyway for waterfowl. It's hard not to notice in Wisconsin, where I live, the connections between conservation and hunting. That so many of the lands that have been preserved and that make the lives of ducks possible in a sort of shrinking environment have been set aside by hunters. And that history also plays out with elephants. It's undeniably the case that some of the strongest proponents of establishing parks very much after a model of land control and management based on certain kinds of European models, but the establishment of these parks in Africa and other places that were partly set aside to protect elephants were pushed strongly by hunters who were not necessarily market hunters and were not necessarily ivory hunters, but were sort of typically sport hunters or scientific collectors. So one has to somehow acknowledge the connections between the the wishes desires of hunters to preserve the hunt and to preserve the opportunity to be in nature with animals and their conservation. That's true today too with various ways that states use licensing fees as conservation tools. And also in the case of some places also using now, you know, sort of tourist dollars as a way of generating, and tourism has its own kind of relationships to the use of nature. So those I think are all kind of intermingled. It's one can't deny that there might not be elephants walking around today were it not for some very outspoken people who were hunters of elephants and who set aside who had the political power and connections to have large tracts of land set aside. One could, you know, make a really good argument that that was not really necessarily driven by a kind of tree-hugging mentality that that people might often associate perhaps incorrectly with conservation, but it was an older vision that's still important. So again, I don't hunt. I certainly talk to hunters in the process of this project as well, and talk to people who have hunted elephants as part of this project, and trying to understand their perspective and what it is they want in their experience of the world is part of what was driving the project as well.
Yeah. I think in this point, as well as others, you echo two of the seminal books in animal studies. The first one is Derrida's The Animal That Therefore I Am, which in its original title plays with the word being. I mean, je suis as I am and je suis as I follow. So I think Derrida is also playing with this idea that what we are following when we are studying or talking about animals is actually ourselves, the beings that we are. And then the other text is Vinciane Desprez, as she asks, what would animals say if we asked the right questions, or at least other questions that have more to do with the lives of these specific animals and their interactions and affordances, and what would happen, what kinds of elephants would bloom in our thoughts if we shifted our attention towards their interests and practices. And I think the best example of this problem is materialized in Carl Ackerley's sculpture, The Alarm, which is a depiction of a classic nuclear family. I would even say a classic American Pie family, which is presented, and I quote, sensing but standing up to danger, sensing the hunter, sensing perhaps their own destruction. This is one of the images that I found most staggering in your book, along with the photograph used in Schilling's book, The Spell of the Elelesho, and also Gonda with his trainer. So one last question would be if you can talk about these images and how images of elephants and things like cages, chains, ribbons, pink tutus, and people like men and women and children in strikingly different positions and gestures have contributed to the configuration of what are common notions about elephants in Western cultures. I think these images are framed in certain ways with words, but also are used as framing devices for certain discourses. So can you say a few words about that?
Maybe we should book a whole hour to talk about that, because that was such a fantastic question. And I can say that no one has pointed to that image of the alarm in talking to me about the book yet. So I wanted to thank you for that. Certainly the photograph you mentioned of Gunda with his keeper is one that I think you're referring to. The last photograph I have of Gunda is one. The book that I was say is one that's very important to me. The book is I think in all my work, I work with a lot of images. I think there might be something like 50 or so in this book. In my practice, in my work, I tend to start with an image, that confuses me in some way, that leaves me with a question. I think that's that's a technique. That's the way I approach my work, and I've always done it that way. I like an artifact to begin with, and it's usually an image, although sometimes it's a text, but it's usually an image. And I like to spend time really looking carefully within, without it becoming too much, at images. Your connections to Derrida and Despre, I think I want to thank you for that. As a writer, I don't talk about other people writing in my field. There are references to people in my notes, but they're not in the text. And I like to write to an audience that doesn't know the literature, but I want people who know the literature to read the book and go, oh, well, there's that connection and there's that connection, because they're in my mind. I just don't want to make them explicit. Going back to our beginning of our discussion, when we were talking a little bit before this, we were talking about dissertations and books, and that's one of the joys of writing a book versus a dissertation, right? As in a dissertation, you have to make all that explicit, and in a book, you don't have to if that's not the work you want to do. So I know we don't have much time, but I'll just say, I think the images are absolutely central to this whole book and the whole project. I wanted the images to be a kind of an album. An album is such a wrong concept. It's because that's a kind of collecting and a kind of owning and a kind of personal memoir, which I don't really want the book to be. But it is a personal book, and these pictures, the photographs, really do matter to me. And if you write about elephants, your options are endless for images, and to be able to select the ones that are meaningful to you is part of the pleasure. So I'll leave it there.
Well, Nigel, I think we have taken a lot of your time, so I will just ask you, what are you working on now?
Butterflies.
Oh. Slightly different.
Or not. It's turning out that I will be writing about some of the most charismatic butterflies that have ever existed. So maybe it's the same story. But it's a book about it's a book project, and I started it about 15 years ago. It's just been kind of maybe just floating around as I've been working on this one, and now I'm turning to it properly. Yeah, it's about butterflies and the late 19th century and colonial fantasies and passions and what we're to make of it 100 years on.
That sounds like an exciting project, and I would...
It'll keep me busy for a few years.
Yeah, I would sure like to see some of its outcomes. I really want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Marcella, it was a real pleasure, and thank you for reading the book with such attention and care. I really enjoyed this very much.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone, and thank you for listening to the New Books Network podcast. Bye.